And really, again, and I'm using these historical 60s, 70s, and then bringing them up to date with some more to show you this has been around a long time. There's a quote there from Wallach from 1972, is that the promise of growth acts as a substitute for equality. And it's probably best expressed in the myth, and it is a myth because you have to be asleep to believe it, of the American dream, that everybody who works hard can succeed and become a millionaire. As a really interesting political, sociological or cultural point, that in America, and the evidence is there in terms of social surveys, even poor people will not want to see taxes on millionaires for the reason that they really believe, why would I tax my son or daughter, or perhaps even myself? It's an outlier. In most other countries, poorer people tend to want more taxes on the broader shoulders and so on. And I think Herman Daly, who in one respect is the grandfather of green economics, puts it there. You don't need equality because a bigger cake is better for you. You can have an absolute share that's bigger rather than a more relative share of a smaller cake, but it's more equally divided. And more recently, a book that many of us have read, certainly in the academy and elsewhere, The Spirit Level. And what they argue in that book, this is Wilkinson and Pickett, who are epidemiologists who are looking at the statistics in terms of health and obesity and tracking that against measures of Gini coefficients of inequality and so on, is that they say inequality drives consumerism and competition because of the status competition that's involved. You live in a more unequal society. How you dress, how you look, are you wearing the right clothes matters much more. I'm stepping outside that tonight and I'm actually dressed half decently. But it is a sad reality that children in our schools are being bullied. Many of you heard me say this before, not because of the horrible reasons that I grew up with. You had glasses, you had ginger hair, you had freckles or whatever. Children are terribly cruel, aren't they, Dervla? But they're being bullied because they're not wearing the Nike top or the Donna Karan New York shoes or the Jimmy Choo shoes. We've created a culture in which our young people feel bad about themselves over the goods that they may not be able to afford. And this is perfectly in line with Wilkinson Pickett's argument that a more unequal society leads to this situation. I think the importance of shame, that sense of shame, that you'll find in many houses, often in poorer areas of Belfast, you go downstairs and they'll have the IKEA furniture, the 70-inch flat-screen television, and nothing else in the house. Because that's what's seen to be a normal member of our society in terms of status. And actually, psychologically, this is one for my wife Yvonne, who's a psychologist, is that inequality increases status competition, which causes consumerism. Normal, healthy, self-respecting adults do not typically go on consumer binges or feel that they have to live their lives through the accumulation of more and more goods. So more inequality, you have these notions of inferiority and superiority within society. There's insecurity in terms of how people feel, how they present themselves. And we're more worried about how people judge us because we're not wearing the right clothes. And this is as a causal, not correlation, it's a causal connection with socioeconomic inequality. Sorry, Noel, I'm going to wrap up soon. And all this brings back to me how, in the condition of wealth and affluence, this neoliberal or capitalist model has to perpetuate the myth of constant scarcity. There's never enough. In the midst of plenty, where the real debate should be around redistribution, we are fed a constant diet in the media, in public policy, in our political debate, the idea of this constant bogey person of scarcity. And for me, this is a mythic construction. We often think that because we live in a world with the internet and the iPhone, that we're not prone to myths. I would say that economic growth is the modern myth by which we live. We have this idea of perpetual scarcity. There's no serious debate about how can we democratically regulate certain limits, or certainly certain needs and wants in favour of others. And just as an example of this is data from 1970 to 2010, So you get reported levels of happiness in the UK. They're kind of bumping along. So people are basically the same going across decades. We have the economy going up, more or less. Of course, there's been bumps and grinds in terms of recessions and depressions. Or a more graphic representation. So there's GDP, and here's life satisfaction. So all that growth, all that frantic activity of consumerism, of energy, of pollution, of resources, hasn't appreciably added to self-reported levels of life satisfaction. Well, why don't we design public policy for this bit? This is only a proxy, or at times it can be a necessary means, but why are we focusing all our energies on orthodox economic growth rather than life satisfaction and human flourishing? And particularly for me, one of the intrinsic elements of the modern capitalist system is debt-based consumerism, excessive consumption as a weapon of mass distraction. It's called a rat race for a reason. And this is essentially the model that we have in our economy. Whoever dies with the most stuff wins. And for me, I think we need to come up with a different model of human flourishing than the one that we have on offer within consumer capitalism. And this is my own contribution, what I call negative Aristotelianism. Don't bother yourselves too much around trying to figure out exactly what that means. But what it is that I think we can identify quasi-objective features of a good human life. And this scares a lot of liberals, because it means that are you promoting a singular view of the good life? Well, I'm not. It's about the removing of those barriers preventing people to live decent, flourishing lives, of which I believe there's a range. There isn't only just one good life. And it is about, as I mentioned here, the speedy reduction of the features that are preventing people from choosing these options to fulfil their capabilities to live a human, flourishing life. So I think we can specify aspects of the context in which people live that are actively undermining. Living in crappy accommodation, being constantly told that you're stupid. I mean, these are some of the easy features we can identify that are preventing people from living high quality lives. But this is where I differ from a lot of the work, or some of the work on happiness and well-being. I have the rather, it could be heretical, but I think it's a realistic and normatively compelling vision that human flourishing, this is why I'm an Aristotelian in that sense, is not the same as being blissed out and happy all the time, a kind of eudaimonia. I do believe that death, sickness, and the recognition of our vulnerabilities are all part of what it means to live a good human life. And it is something that is rather worrying that we have a undue focus in our Western culture on vitality and youth and perfection, whereas actually that is not always accurate as a description of human beings. And I think particularly in Western culture, we have a difficulty in recognising dependency and interdependency on each other. Even in liberal political theory, the ideal is the autonomous, the independent, typically male, who are removed from the dependencies of child caring, of looking after the old and the sick. So I'm not celebrating vulnerability, but it is a recognised that vulnerability and dependency is an ineliminable condition of what it means to be human. It has to be acknowledged and recognised. And I also think that in most public policy, even in political theory, the vision of the human being as independent, as able-bodied, as being unencumbered by dependency is of a snapshot. It's typically a youthful individual before they get married, independent, able to go out and work 24/7 and party and so on. That's the kind of the image of the human being that we often get presented. That's what economics in particular presents. Whereas if you view the human being over the course of a lifespan, there are times when we're sick, when we're vulnerable, when we have to look after other relatives. Yet that's not factored in often to the image of the human being that we get in political theory, and certainly not in economics. And McIntyre, whose politics were kind of different to mine, Alistair McIntyre, I think he at least had the good grace in a book to recognise that this is something that even he had in his own work, and he's one of the preeminent political philosophers in certainly Western theory, where we don't recognise vulnerability in how we even think as political theorists. And all this leads then, not going to surprise you, that I do think we have to start thinking about notions of human flourishing beyond consumerism. Finding time for the simple things in life. And I speak against myself, as always, as Yvonne reminds me. Here's somebody promoting green politics, quality of life, and actively not having one in terms of at one stage, and I don't know whether Saoirse put Dervla up to it, at around the breakfast table, Dervla says, "Who are you?" But the issue here is that this movement towards a more simple life, voluntary simplicity, having less things, being mindful, as Peter Doran constantly reminds me, requires some degree of economic security. And I'm going to use here the International Labour Organization's definition. This is to replace economic growth. And it's the bits in bold I want you to focus on. The most important determinant of national happiness is not income level. There is a positive association, but it trails off. The key factor is the extent of income security through public policy and income protection, and particularly a low degree of inequality. In other words, if you want to promote economic security, we need to basically make our societies less unequal and provide extensive forms of social protection and income protection. So my prognosis or my proposition is to replace economic growth with economic security. One way of doing this, and again, John Baker and Tony Weeks and others have done a lot of work, certainly on the island of Ireland, of promoting a basic income scheme as one way of getting us there to a less unsustainable economy. It certainly would achieve reducing inequality. It would certainly enhance human freedom to be freed from the compulsion of taking a crappy, low-paid, non-unionised job out of economic compulsion. Basic income would at least remove that as a distortion of what it means to be free. But also, I think, free up the area of the economy that's often the Cinderella in our economic imaginary of the social economy. We usually have the public sector and the private sector. What about the social economy? Which I think a lot of the sustainable, life-enhancing, human flourishing providing opportunities actually lie within the social economy. And why not tax the rich and get away from income and start taxing assets and wealth and not just income? What about reducing the working week? It's always been a constant puzzle to me, is that why such an intelligent species as ours, with our technological ingenuity, certainly since the Industrial Revolution, every technological revolution has led to less people working more rather than more people working less. Again, Your Honour, capitalism in the dock in terms of the reasons for that. Why don't we start seriously considering and modelling how can we redesign the economy around the New Economics Foundation idea of reducing the average working week to 20 hours and to realise the productivity gains of technological innovation in terms of more free time rather than more stuff and more income. And therein becomes the political bargain that has to be attended to. But all of this requires greater flexibility, certainly more gender justice in terms of childcare and looking after issues in the home. And what I'm talking about here is more meaningful free time, not unemployment, rather than more stuff. Or more radically, why don't we democratise the workplace? And I see Mel Corrie is here, along with others are here from Trademark, a workers' cooperative. Or democratise, allow workers even in non-cooperatively organised workplaces to have more say. And this is a challenge for those of you who are trade unionists. Why don't we see the trade unions arguing for more power to workers in the workplace rather than simply better pay and conditions? That's a major challenge. He's not here tonight, but a colleague, Keith Breen, does a lot of work on what about the internal goods of labour? In other words, that you engage in labour not just for the income that you get out of it at the end of the week or the month, but the intrinsic joy of working on something either together or on your own. I mean, it's telling that in orthodox capitalist economics, what I was taught in UCD many, many years ago, work is seen as disutility. Wages are your compensation for the disutility you feel while working. Well, why not try and create more utility in work, more autonomy in work, some creativity, beauty in the work conditions? These are ideas that weren't seen so crazy 40 years ago. Even hearing myself say them here in 2014, it sounds so old. It shows you how far our political debate has become degraded in terms of the opportunities available to us. And I also think that democratising work will help create a democratic society. And this is definitely in a reference to Alexis de Tocqueville. In other words, beyond simply a democratic system, why should democracy enter the factory gate or the lecture theatre door? Give citizens in a work situation more experience of autonomy, of conflict resolution. This will help create a more democratic and, I would say, vibrant and healthy society. These are some examples. We've got the Belfast Cleaning Cooperative. This is a fantastic pamphlet that was produced by Trademark. And Mondragon, of course, is it's like Sweden for social democrats. Mondragon is the classic massive Spanish cooperatively organised institute in terms of banking, production, and so on. And they have faces. This is what worker democracy looks like. What about considering that as a way to create a less unsustainable and more just world? What about, I see William in the audience and others, reform the monetary system? I won't go into the complete details of this, but essentially all the money we create in our society is private money that's essentially issued as debt. And the financial institutions and the financial sector of our economy is parasitic on the manufacturing and the real economy. It's out of kilter, another form of disembedding. And I think for a sustainable post-growth society, we have to issue the money in terms of a public institution, the state. I think banks, private banks, would be prohibited from creating money and issuing it as debt. And finally, what about quantitative easing for the people as opposed to particular sections of the economy? But the reasons, just to recap, why the capitalist economy is locked into this ecocidal growth path. States are planning their expenditure that the economy will grow. Companies are legally obliged. There's a fiduciary duty on corporate financial officers and CEOs to get the best return for their shareholders. And of course, when you create money as debt, it bears interest, which means you've got to get back more money than you lent. So therefore, there's an implicit dynamic that the economy has to grow. But here's a radical idea. What would an economy look like if it was designed by a scientist with some basic understanding of the laws of thermodynamics and ecology as opposed to a neoclassical economist? And that's our decisions. I think this is a situation we stand at as a society and a civilization. It's the equivalent of St. Augustine's view of make me chaste but not yet, where we all want to be sustainable. And we have loads of evidence in terms of surveys of people wanting to be, you know, more sustainable and green. We don't see much action often. It's a bit like the Irish football team, as many of you heard me say before, great on paper, crap on grass. So just to begin to wrap up, what's this got the connection with carbon and oil? It literally is the fuel of the capitalist economy. And again, many of you heard me say this before, versions of this talk that I seem to have been given for the past 20 years. Name me one thing in this room, one thing, that isn't made in whole or part or transported in whole or part without the use of oil or coal or gas. We've built an entire industrial civilization on a non-renewable, climate-changing energy source. And moving away from that is the biggest challenge, or one of the biggest challenges in the transition from unsustainability. Oh, and it also causes wars. And this is the situation we're in. We've now reached the stage of extracting the maximum amount of oil in the planet's surface. Although Stefan, who's smiling, Riley, my colleague, we have debates whether or not fracking will extend this particular scenario. And the issue isn't really when this point of maximum extraction happens. It's something we'll only ever see in the rearview mirror. Is that at some point, it's a geological fact. Ever since we dug the first coal out of the ground or barrel of oil, we've already begun to degrade the resource because it's non-renewable. And yet we've built this society on this non-renewable, climate-changing resource. And it's us that have done it. Again, one of these maps adjusted to give the accurate description of the oil used. It's in the minority world, look at even Japan, not in Africa, South America, or even China and India. It's a small portion of the human family that have gorged themselves on oil to create a high consumption society that's now causing climate change. And this is a very serious situation politically, certainly for the island of Ireland or Northern Ireland. We are very energy dependent and vulnerable. We're at the end of the pipeline in terms of a lot of these supplies of carbon. And the reality is this, though, is that the climate change reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us that we have corporations with five times more oil and coal reserves and gas than we think it's safe to burn. If you actually look at the financial dynamics in terms of investment and capitalization in these large energy corporations, they are betting we're going to fry the planet. That's the great thing about capitalism. You can fry the planet, engage on an ecocidal course of rivet-popping the planet's life defense systems, and still make money. And this is the real challenge. How can we leave oil before oil leaves us? This is for any climate skeptics out there. But it gets better or worse depending on your analysis, is that literally energy is the driving force of the economy. In other words, the economy is dependent upon the available energy. So there are serious crunches and limits if we don't have energy cheaply and securely available to us. And particularly this point here is that when an economy starts spending more than 5% of its budget, and we in Northern Ireland, John Woods here probably know the figure, it's probably more than 5%, you can tip the economy into a recession. As an example of that, you can have a graph here that correlates US recessions in the peaks of the price, the real price of oil. It doesn't always happen, but invariably there is a relationship between the peaking of oil and the US economy going into recession. But how can we still explain that this ecocidal system is still enthusiastically supported within society? In fact, it's being promoted within universities. We hear it in our news broadcast on the radio. And I think part of the reason for this is that we have to accept, those who are radical, like me, is that people like this system. They may be locked into it, but they actually like it, and therefore that makes it a compelling case for how do we begin to challenge that. I think you can begin by saying, well, what is it about the construction of this myth, of this new common sense that we need to analyse in terms of economic growth? Which leads me to my academic work on actually looking at why consumerism and economic growth are our new modern myths. Our identities are tied up, our aspirations are tied up in this new myth. In the same way that every society, because we're narrative beings, we tell stories to ourselves. And the story our society tells to itself is one around endless economic growth. This is where any liberals in the room maybe get very twitchy, because Plato wasn't a democrat. But those of you who've read Plato's Republic, and some of you perhaps haven't, it's the idea that the philosopher, he's outside the cave, he's got access to knowledge, and he's been set free of the shadows. So in other words, what people think is real, this is the ordinary world of most people, isn't actually real, and the philosopher knows. Now, there are many dangers in this, because it can lead into a very anti-democratic, where experts will tell us how to live and so on. But for me, I read a modern version of Plato's Allegory of the Cave as the obligation of those of us who are privileged knowledge workers, who do have access and the time and the luxury to be able to think about these things, and what's our contribution in this time of crisis. And particularly begin to see this even in climate activism. How radical is that, Sammy Wilson? But what we get as a response to unsustainability is this business as usual approach, the continuation of technological solutions. And this has minimal, as I mentioned before, political and ethical input. And essentially it's a vision of the future that's a greening of what we have with better apps. And we tend to project into the future that it's going to be like the way it is today, but slightly better. And particularly for me, this techno-optimistic approach, and again, I'm not a Luddite, but I am drawing into sharp relief the way in which technological solutions by themselves rob us of the political opportunity to really restructure society, look at the ethical issues that underlie the way society is organised. And I think it's time to get radical, in that Latin sense of the term, of getting to the roots of something, no longer being content with end-of-pipe solutions. Design out problems. We shouldn't need laws against the inclusion of toxic materials in the substances that we buy. That is a design failure. We should be designing out aspects of our economy which are causing all of these problems, some of which I've mentioned. I think it's time for disruptive politics. And particularly this last point, I'm always amazed that even in the academy, we tend to view entrepreneurship and innovation very technical and also in the business, commercial sense. But what about innovation and new ways of living, in political innovation and democratisation, workers' cooperatives? Why isn't that seen on Invest NI's agenda, for example, as one of the public institutions charged with promoting innovation and entrepreneurship? And part of it is because of this issue of avoiding politics and ethics. But also it's about sustaining the unsustainable. I'm so radical, I don't want a green version of what we have at the moment. A low-carbon version of an inequality-producing and human-flourishing-denying type of society. I think we can think bigger and better than that. And we don't need any new technologies, necessarily. What we need is the political will and the courage to do so. But key to all of this, it has to be a just transition. We cannot have the transition to away from unsustainability without attending to the issues of justice and injustice, as I mentioned at the start. And I think this is, for me, the go to the issue of the academic side of this debate. It's about a new form of mission-led research, that we have a major challenge in society, in the world. And this is an appeal for a type of mission-led academic research agenda. It's explicitly interdisciplinary. No one discipline has the solutions. It's transdisciplinary, which I'm understanding as it's engaged. You have to go outside the academy, and not just to where academics usually go or are encouraged to go, which is to business. But what about going to civil society, going to citizens, asking citizens what do they want from academics? What about upstreaming citizen involvement in academic research? And I think it's about encouraging an academic mode of research that is emancipatory. You know, partly on the back of that idea that knowledge will set you free, but at least to let people realise the contradictions in our society, the possibilities that are there, rather than accepting this myth of this new common sense that I've mentioned. And this is a post-normal science, for those of you who might be interested in this. It's about where facts and values come together. We have to show our knowledge, show how we've come to our perspective in public. This is called extended peer review. And it's very important in the climate change debate. But it's also beyond disinterested knowledge production. It is interested knowledge in making the world a better place, in challenging inequality, challenging injustice, challenging ignorance. And that's something that we haven't had in the academy in terms of a debate since the 1970s. And it's about generating an awareness of the contradictions of our society, debating whether or not the analysis I've given is even half correct, or a third, or a tenth correct. But let's not shy away from engaging in that debate about the analysis of the contradictions of society. And particularly, to use knowledge and knowledge production as a way for social transformation, and not just simply technological innovation. And this may be called, rather grandiosely, perhaps a Green New Deal for the academy, reclaiming the mission of science and social science to improve the human condition. I think publicly funded research, we have an obligation, those of us paid out of the public tax purse, to give something back. And I do welcome developments in the management of academics in terms of impact and so on, in terms of us demonstrating how our knowledge is making a difference. And particularly, as I say, upstreaming citizen involvement in terms of they're paying our wages. Now, they may not always be able to articulate exactly what it is that they want, but they should be included in some way, in a way that they often aren't now. Well, in terms of education, and one of my great heroes, Paolo Ferreri, is that education can be used simply as a system of indoctrinating the young into accepting the current status quo. And because some of you here, like myself, send their children to a Steiner school, this is also Rudolf Steiner's perspective, that education can be stultifying and simply about imposing an order on that which doesn't deserve to have an order imposed upon it. Or education can be about liberation and emancipation. Again, even saying that now sounds so bizarre. There goes John again. And what is it about our deracinated political imagination that we cannot even talk about these more radical ideas in the academy? And if you don't want Ferreri, take the Deering Report from 1997, which encourages us to have a view of the academy and education as part of a democratic culture. It's a pity Stephen Farry isn't here, who's going to bring down cuts upon us. So, to conclude, this system of capitalism has locked us into an ecocidal, irrational economic system. It's past the threshold beyond which is actually adding to human flourishing, locked us into debt-based consumerism, and it has made a permanent feature of the economy that which should only be seen as temporary and a transition phase in human development. It's cooking the planet, creating geopolitical instability, and it's undermining the possibilities of human flourishing for future generations. So we need system change, not climate change. And I think Wilkinson and Pickett hit it on the head. That this is not an anti-growth message. It's to say growth has done its job. We should pat it on the head and move on to a different paradigm of the human economy and human development. So we need a paradigm shift in how we think about the economy and economics. I've outlined some of the arguments we can have about replacing economic growth with economic security. And in particular, we should be focusing the academy, our technological innovation, human creativity, on improving not the ecological efficiency of economic growth. That's where the vast majority of research is spent, by research councils, by the R&D of companies. But why don't we focus improving the ecological efficiency of human flourishing, not necessarily economic growth? I think there are three R's that we're going to have to get used to in thinking about this paradigm shift: reduction, redundancy, and resilience. We could solve energy problems by reducing and stopping wasting so much energy rather than always focusing on the increase of supply. Redundancy is a technical term that anybody who has any connection with the land would know. You don't max out the land in terms of fertilizers and growing more crops. You need to lay it fallow. So you build in redundancy, so it has a capacity to regenerate. And we need to reduce resource use rather than simply try and decouple it. And what are the best things in life really are free? And ask ourselves that question we don't often ask. Is something desired because it's good, or good because it's desired? It's marketed to be desired. We need to be aware of thresholds. Again, move to economic security. And it has to be a just transition so that there isn't inequality as part of this transition. These are all my friends from Friends of the Earth. There's Dr. Foe. We get a clash, the deep political, ethical clashes between the choices we make in terms of how we want to live our lives. So I offer you a vision of radical hope. I haven't given you a lot of the answers, and this is Jonathan Lear, who wrote a wonderful book on the idea of radical hope. It's about anticipating a good which those who have the hope, we lack the appropriate concept. We don't even know often exactly what it is that we desire. Hence my focus on injustice and unsustainability. And particularly in terms of both the academic work but also political activism, our job as radicals, in my view, is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. And to finish, there are no ecological limits, as far as I know, to these things. And this, to my mind, is the good stuff of human society and life. And where do we see a serious debate around this in terms of making this transition from unsustainability? And these technological approaches that we often see to unsustainability, they rob us again of the opportunity to see that there's an upside to down. The crisis we're in can be an opportunity, not just to create a greener version of what we have, but a better society, one with higher levels of social quality, solidarity, and forms of human flourishing. But to do this, we have to be unreasonable. As George Bernard Shaw said, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. So let's be unreasonable. Thank you.